This is Gulf Coast Life Arts Edition from WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. The Southwest Florida Symphony's 59th season continues Saturday evening in a concert that will see Steve Hackman return as conductor. Hackman is a composer, arranger, conductor, pianist, vocalist, producer, DJ, rapper, and musical visionary, best known for his unique style of classical pop fusion, blending the orchestral works from the masters of classical composition with the music of popular contemporary artists. Hackman, who studied counterpoint composition and improvisation at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, has brought his unique mashup arrangements to audiences all over the country in concerts with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, the Colorado Symphony, the Seattle, Oregon, and Nashville Symphonies, and the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, to name just a few. He's brought his shows to international audiences as well. Past seasons of the Southwest Florida Symphony have included Hackman conducting his works Brahms v. Radiohead, and Beethoven versus Coldplay. Saturday evening's performance at the Barbara B. Mann Performing Arts Hall in Fort Myers is called Mashup Palooza, a Stereo Hideout production, and will serve as a kind of sonic tour through a fictional music festival, including mashups of Beethoven and Beyonce, Stravinsky and Daft Punk, Brahms and Lady Gaga, and Bach and Bruno Mars, to name a few. Joining us now for a closer exploration of these unique works ahead of Saturday's concert is Steve Hackman himself. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Life Arts Edition. Great to reconnect with you.
Absolutely, John. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the intro.
And to engage with us and your fellow listeners about this conversation or any of our shows, find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. And in the interest of full disclosure, the Southwest Florida Symphony is an underwriter of the station. Now, in one of our past conversations, Steve, I'd asked that proverbial chicken or egg question about which came first in your life, classical or popular contemporary music. And as you said, probably in many interviews before, neither. Your interest in music kind of across the genre spectrum has run on these parallel tracks your whole life. And that makes me wonder about your early childhood upbringing. Did you grow up in a home where music appreciation was heavily emphasized?
Well,
was it just kind of something you found on your own? Okay.
I would say more the latter. I hesitate because both my parents do appreciate music so much. My mom, having grown up in Detroit, she was crazy about Motown artists and would go to the Motown reviews. And my dad has always had an avid interest in music, but they didn't play it around the house. I sort of discovered it. I remember just leafing through my dad's LP collection and, just seeing this kind of ominous-looking box of Beethoven symphonies conducted by Toscanini and just, being drawn to it and putting it on. And my dad had a cassette tape that he had dubbed of a favorite Chopin selections album, and I was obsessed with that cassette tape. So I really, I was just drawn to it and sort of discovered on my own. It wasn't something that was played to me by my parents.
Gotcha. And then conversely, you're also, as a kid, recording on cassette tapes, pieces played on the radio, contemporary music, so definitely doing both. What about your formal music education? At what age did you begin studying piano, and was that your first instrument?
Piano was my first instrument. My parents bought a piano because they wanted to put my sister in lessons because she'd shown interest in it. And I was around, I think, 6 at the time. And they bought the piano, and I sort of just started playing it by ear. And they thought, well, we ought to put Steven in lessons, too. So thus began piano lessons for me.
And when did you discover that you had a knack or an interest in singing as well?
Singing was high school. I certainly wish it would have been earlier in my development, but I joined choir in high school because my sister said, this is a great way for you to meet girls. So freshman year, joined choir. And that really opened up everything for me because having been a pianist at that point, I was called upon to lead rehearsals, and that began sort of my first conducting sort of experiments. And I started arranging quickly. We formed a little barbershop group when I was in high school, and really choir is what sort of opened up all those other musical pathways that have led here.
Yeah. Was there ever a time in your life, you know, perhaps when you were studying at Curtis, when the contemporary music interest just was kind of forced to take a back seat to your classical studies, or maybe some other situation where it was reversed?
Well, that's an interesting question. Depending on my activity and focus at the time, of course, one would have to be a bit subordinate to the other. And that is how my life is even right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I spent January and February writing the next orchestral fusion piece, which is Mahler mixed with Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac, and was also on the road conducting a lot. So, therefore, my own music, my own popular music, whatever you want to call it, was taking a back seat to that. But all last summer, I was working on my next album of original music. Therefore, the classical endeavors were more in the back seat. Though it's classical's never quite in the background, because I'm conducting so much these days that, you know, any given week I'm usually putting on a show somewhere. So it very much is kind of who I am. I think really it's just about how actively am I pursuing my own music right now.
Right, right. Well, and you've been doing specifically these, you know, classical pop fusion style pieces for, I guess, about 10 years now. How many do you have on the books?
I think there are 9 productions right now. Yeah, it's been, well, not quite 10 years, though my relationship with, we can kind of calculate by my relationship with the Indianapolis Symphony, because they're the first ones that gave me the platform to do this, and it's an orchestra I return to, with great pleasure, and I'm honored to be back there multiple times per year. So I did start going there in 2010, though, and I think the first real sort of fusion piece was written around 12. So, yeah, it's been quite a while.
Yeah. I know past performances you've brought to the Southwest Florida Symphony have tended to focus on one particular classical work and one particular contemporary artist or even a whole album like Radiohead's OK Computer. But I get the impression that Mashup Palooza is going to be a whole other ballgame. Can you describe it for us?
Very much is, and you're right. So to that point, I had written, I think, 5 full-length productions that had focused on a singular pairing of artist and composer. And so it was sort of in the back of my mind, let's change this up and see what more of a kind of a variety of artists and composers would look like. And then I was having a discussion with some friends. We were talking about what the best music festival in the world was. Was it Coachella or Glastonbury or New Orleans Blues Festival or, you know, the Salzburg Festival or Lausanne Festival? And I got home that night and I was thinking, gosh, it's too bad that these classical oriented festivals and these pop oriented festivals don't, you know, mix together. Like, you know, you go to one for classical and then you go to one for pop. Like,
right.
What a shame that you can't go to Coachella and hear the LA Phil or the Las Vegas Phil or the San Diego, you know, Symphony. And then I started to think, gosh, what would that look like? You know, what if I was the curator or the producer of one of these festivals? What would I play with an orchestra? And then I continue that line of thought and kind of spread the imagination open more and thought, gosh, what a fantastical experience it would be if you could actually have Bach and Mozart and Mahler and Beethoven and Strauss in the same festival, in person, as 21 Pilots and Bruno Mars and Kanye West and Lady Gaga. You know, what would that be like if you could have all these artists in their prime, you know, making music together and interacting and hanging out backstage and improvising and all this. And that was the kind of nexus, the moment where the idea for this show was born.
All right. And you address this in your TEDx talk, which I would encourage everybody to check out. You can find it online at stevehackman.com. But how do you respond to the so-called purist who maybe would consider what you're doing to these classical works as just downright blasphemous?
Well, firstly, I would say I understand that perspective, because I would assure them that I love this music at least as much as they do, or more.
Yeah.
This is my life, and I have a voracious appetite and an unlimited capacity to love music, and so I get it. I worship this music just like they do. But that being said, this is not meant to replace, you know, that repertoire. Brahms versus Radiohead is not meant to replace the Brahms First Symphony, or in any way is it meant to insinuate that that piece is not perfect on its own. It's simply a new perspective. It's looking at it in a different way, and it's kind of reimagining it by combining it with something else. One of the problems with the critics of this work is, I think, a lack of understanding of just where we are in contemporary musical culture, and just the idea of the remix as a worthwhile artistic endeavor. You know, that's something in the popular world. We know that a remix is just it's a different shade, and it's of the original. It's casting a different light on it.
Yeah.
It's allowing us to experience it in a different way. In no way is it saying this is meant to be the official version, and does it eschew the original?
Yeah. Do you find the purists tend to come from the classical music camp? Because it seems to me that contemporary popular artists have kind of long been embracing collaborations and genre blending.
I would say that's true. I would say most... Now, again, as I was just saying, I wish I could talk to the critics more and have this kind of very... lively and interesting discussion with them. But there are critics on both sides. I mean, whenever you have passionate lovers of a certain thing, you're going to ruffle some feathers when you propose some sort of adaptation of it. So Radiohead fans are hardcore. I'm one of them. And so when you take OK Computer and you reimagine it another way, you're going to have people that say, no, I only want Thom Yorke singing it. I need that shredding Telecaster of Johnny Greenwood. You know, this sounds to me like just total blasphemy. You'll have it on both sides.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're just joining the show, we're speaking with musical visionary Steve Hackman. He'll conduct the Southwest Florida Symphony this Saturday evening in a performance. And if you would like to comment on our conversation or engage with fellow listeners, find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Now, you know, of course, we can't ask Brahms or Beethoven what they would think. But when it comes to the contemporary artists whose work you draw from, how do they tend to receive what you're doing? Because I know you've gotten some pretty positive reception in the past from some folks.
Yeah, we've gotten positive indicators, and you know, just the fact that an artist of such integrity, and that is so very precious and careful about their intellectual property as Radiohead, allow us to do this. I mean, that's an honor for me, of course. Or like somebody like Bon Iver, who, you know, listened to his record on the plane yesterday, his newest record, and you know, I'm so inspired by him and the fact that he heard Copeland Bon Iver and said, you know, yeah, let's let these guys do this, and that's a great privilege and means a lot to me. So, but they're conversations that I'd like to have more and more, and frankly, you know, kind of the end game for me, or sort of a real dream and goal, is to start to work with these artists. And so take that to the next step with somebody like Justin Byrne and say, all right, you've heard this piece, and now what would you dream for an orchestral collaborative experience? You know, what's in your mind? Like, let's realize it. Let's team up and do that.
Yeah, yeah. Have you yet had the opportunity to collaborate in that direct way, you know, conducting one of your fusion pieces with the actual pop artist performing? Because I'm thinking, as your notoriety continues to grow, that just seems like a natural next step.
I do think it's a natural next step, and it's very much kind of one of the main initiatives right now. You know, I'm spending a lot more time in L.A. because a lot of these artists are L.A.-based, and really, that is a big goal right now. So we're trying to put steps in place to make that happen, and we're trying to just get the work out there more and more so that more and more people are hearing it, so that hopefully, Coldplay, catches wind of something and they want to do it. I mean, that they reposted something on Instagram because we did Beethoven Coldplay a couple weeks ago in San Diego, and I think it was close enough to L.A. that they sort of, saw it. So, of course, we were all excited about that, and we wanted to just... unfortunately, I don't have Chris Martin in my cell phone yet, so...
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to that one day. And I'd love to explore your process for creating these unique pieces, because it's different from just... mashing together two songs that have similar chord progressions and are in the same time signature. I mean, you do a lot of reworking and retooling that's very technical. Sometimes the link between the pieces feels more thematic than anything else. And I'm wondering how you even begin the process of writing one of these. Like, how do you select what classical piece would work well with which contemporary artists? Is it like something you hear in your head first? Is it more intuitive in the beginning?
Well, I think it's both. Sometimes you're right. Sometimes there are technical similarities, or there are devices that both musics share, whether it's a key signature or a time signature or a motive or a certain contrapuntal usage. But that's kind of rare. Those things really need to be worked out and sort of invented and worked through. And the music needs to be sort of altered in order to make those linkages work. It is the thematic and just kind of the broader... The nature of the music sometimes that that inspires me to combine them. Beethoven and Coldplay would be a great example of that. I wanted to combine them because they both take on these big, broad, universal themes of love and loss and happiness and sadness and joy and anguish. And that doesn't mean that it's going to work musically. So you need to then get in there and figure out how to make it work. But that's the fun part. In the case of Mashapalooza, the concert we're presenting this weekend, again, I had this scenario in my mind for a music festival where all these artists would be hanging out together. Mm-hmm. And I just, it just started to write itself, because I chose artists, and I always choose music that I love, that I think is essential for people to hear. I'm always kind of wearing the hat as that advocate for classical music. So when I take on a new show, it's like, okay, what piece do I want to introduce, my people to, my audience to, my friends to? And so in this show, I picked some Wagner and some Mahler and Shostakovich, et cetera, and then started to think about the pairings of what would work with that. But really, the scenarios and the narrative is what surprised me about this, because I started to actually... these scenarios just started to write themselves. I could imagine Mahler playing the Uhrlicht from his Resurrection Symphony and John Mayer hearing it and thinking, man, this is a pop song. That's not classical music, that's pop, that's a song. I want to play that on the guitar. And can I jam with you on that when you go on stage? Or, or Adele and Wagner, kind of two champions of voice in different ways, Wagner accompanying Adele with his orchestra and then starting to insert a little music of his own, and Adele saying, wait, what is that? And then Wagner, kind of going off on a an oration about, the meaning of his music, like he was prone to do. So that was really fun about this piece, because that was a fun element of this piece. Because in the other cases, I didn't have that narrative element. I really was just going on pure music. Mm. And in this case, there is that story throughout the whole work of kind of just taking this tour guide, or taking a tour through this imaginary festival and the different encounters along the way and the different happenings.
Right, right. Well, we are coming up towards the end of our conversation, but I would be remiss if we did not talk about West Side X West Side, because, wow, what a ride. And what a fantastic way to link thematic connections across time and culture. Can you tell us a bit about that project?
Well, sure. I'm sure glad to talk about that. So you had a chance to listen to it.
I do a lot of homework.
Well, I appreciate that. West Side versus West Side. Yeah, this was, West Side Story has reopened on Broadway, a new revival production, and it is a West Side Story for 2020. And, you know, they are, in the most thoughtful ways, they are representing, you know, where we are with today as a people, as a collective people. And I wanted to do something to kind of tie in with that, and then also to celebrate, the Bernstein anniversary that we had last year. And, you know, this idea just honestly just came in an instant. I think a friend of mine said, "Well, what are you going to do for Bernstein?" And I said, "I don't know, West Side Story." And he said, "Well, what are you going to combine it with?" Or I said, West Side. I mean, you know, and just kind of jumped in there. It is amazing when you look at the societal and social situation of 1940s, 1950s New York City, which is when this musical was written, and the conditions for poor whites, for Latinos in New York City. And then you look at Compton, California in the 90s, the late 80s, and what was happening, the way that drugs came in, the gang culture, you know, the systematic oppression that people were facing in those two specific situations, and then you listen to the music, and you marvel at how what the creative outlet. And the strength of people to take that situation and turn it into music and to cry out through their creative voice. And that is what West Side Story was, though, of course, West Side Story was, there were some degrees of separation because Robbins and Sondheim and Bernstein were sort of channeling what the youth of the early 50s wanted to say. Whereas in the case of N.W.A. and Dr. Dre and Cypress Hill and these artists, I mean, they lived it.
Right.
And so I wanted to combine the two, and I wanted to show how, you know, merely 40 years and, thousands of miles across the coast, really was no distance at all for these scenarios and these situations, and that they were very, very similar.
Yeah, well done. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show, but I want to thank my guest, composer, arranger, and conductor Steve Hackman. He will take the baton for the Southwest Florida Symphony's performance this Saturday evening of his Mashup Palooza. That's at 7:30 at February 29th, Leap Day, at the Barbara B. Mann Performing Arts Hall at Florida Southwestern State College in Fort Myers. Tickets are still available, but supply is limited. Steve Hackman, thanks so much for taking the time.
Absolutely. It's great to be here.
Our show today was produced by yours truly. Our director is Richard Cinqui. Social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM.